Observations on the discussions concerning free banking. The banking school taught that an overissuance of banknotes is impossible if the bank limits its business to the granting of short-term loans. When the loan is paid back at maturity, the banknotes return to the bank and thus disappear from the market. However, this happens only if the bank restricts the amount of credits granted. But even then, it would not undo the effects of its previous credit expansion. It would merely add to it the effects of a later credit contraction. The regular course of affairs is that the bank replaces the bills expired and paid back by discounting new bills of exchange. Then, to the amount of banknotes withdrawn from the market by the repayment of the earlier loan, there corresponds an amount of newly issued banknotes. The concatenation which sets a limit to credit expansion under a system of free banking works in a different way. It has no reference whatever to the process which this so-called principle of Fullerton has in mind. It is brought about by the fact that credit expansion in itself does not expand a bank's clientele, namely, the number of people who assign to the demand claims against this bank the character of money substitutes. Since the overissuance of fiduciary media on the part of one bank, as has been shown above, increases the amount to be paid by the expanding bank's clients to other people, it increases concomitantly the demand for the redemption of its money substitutes. It thus forces the expanding bank back to a restraint. This fact was never questioned with regard to demand deposits subject to check. It is obvious that an expanding bank would very soon find itself in a difficult position in clearing with other banks. However, people sometimes maintain that things are different as far as banknotes are concerned. In dealing with the problems of money substitutes, Catalactics maintains that the claims in question are dealt with by a number of people, like money, that they are, like money, given away and received in transactions and kept in cash holdings. Everything that Catalactics asserts with regard to money substitutes presupposes this state of affairs. But it would be preposterous to believe that every banknote issued by any bank really becomes a money substitute. What makes a banknote a money substitute is the special kind of goodwill of the issuing bank. The slightest doubt concerning the bank's ability or willingness to redeem every banknote without any delay at any time and with no expense to the bearer impairs this special goodwill and removes the banknote's character as a money substitute. We may assume that everybody not only is prepared to get such questionable banknotes as a loan, but also prefers to receive them as payment instead of waiting longer. But if any doubts exist concerning their prime character, people will hurry to get rid of them as soon as possible. They will keep in their cash holdings money and such money substitutes as they consider perfectly safe, and will dispose of the suspect banknotes. These banknotes will be traded at a discount, and this fact will carry them back to the issuing bank, which alone is bound to redeem them at their full face value. The issue can still better be clarified by reviewing banking conditions in continental Europe. Here, the commercial banks were free from any limitation concerning the amount of deposits subject to check. They would have been in a position to grant circulation credit and thus expand credit by adopting the methods applied by the banks of the Anglo-Saxon countries. However, the public was not ready to treat such bank deposits as money substitutes. As a rule, a man who received a check cashed it immediately and thereby withdrew the amount from the bank. It was impossible for a commercial bank to lend, except for negligible sums, by crediting the debtor's account. As soon as the debtor wrote out a check, a withdrawal of the amount concerned from the bank resulted. Only a small group of big business treated deposits with the country's central bank of issue, not those with the commercial banks, as money substitutes. Although the central banks in most of these countries were not submitted to any legal restrictions with regard to their deposit business, they were prevented from using it as a vehicle of large-scale credit expansion because the clientele for deposit currency was too small. Banknotes were practically the sole instrument of circulation credit and credit expansion. Similar conditions prevailed, and for the most part still prevail, by and large, in all countries of the world which are outside the pale of Anglo-Saxon banking methods. In the 80s of the 19th century, the Austrian government embarked upon a project of popularizing checkbook money by establishing a checking account department with the Post Office Savings Service. It succeeded to some degree. Balances with this department of the post office were treated as money substitutes by a clientele which was broader than that of the checking account department of the country's central bank of issue. The system was later preserved by the new states, which in 1918 succeeded the Habsburg Empire. It has also been adopted by many other European nations, for instance, Germany. It is important to realize that this kind of deposit currency was a purely governmental venture, and that the circulation credit that the system granted was exclusively lent to the governments. It is characteristic that the name of the Austrian Post Office Savings Institution, and likewise of most of its foreign replicas, was not Savings Bank, but Savings Office. Apart from these demand deposits with the government post system in most of the non-Anglo-Saxon countries, banknotes, and, to a small extent, also deposits with the government-controlled central bank of issue, are the only vehicles of circulation credit. In speaking of credit expansion with regard to these countries, one refers almost entirely to banknotes. In the United States, many employers pay salaries and even wages by writing out checks. As far as the payees immediately cash the checks received and withdraw the whole amount from the bank, the method means merely that the onerous burden of manipulating coins and banknotes is shifted from the employer's cashier to the bank's cashier. It has no catalactic implications. If all citizens were to deal in this way with checks received, the deposits would not be money substitutes and could not be used as instruments of circulation credit. It is solely the fact that a considerable part of the public looks upon deposits as money substitutes that makes them what is popularly called checkbook money or deposit currency. It is a mistake to associate with the notion of free banking the image of a state of affairs under which everybody is free to issue banknotes and to cheat the public ad libitum. People often refer to the dictum of an anonymous American quoted by Tooke, "Free trade in banking is free trade in swindling." However, freedom in the issuance of banknotes would have narrowed down the use of banknotes considerably if it had not entirely suppressed it. It was this idea which Chernusky advanced in the hearings of the French banking inquiry on October 24, 1865. "I believe that what is called freedom of banking would result in a total suppression of banknotes in France. I want to give everybody the right to issue banknotes so that nobody should take any banknotes any longer." People may uphold the opinion that banknotes are more handy than coins, and that considerations of convenience recommend their use. As far as this is the case, the public would be prepared to pay a premium for the avoidance of the inconveniences involved in carrying a heavy weight of coins in their pockets. Thus, in earlier days, banknotes issued by banks of unquestionable solvency stood at a slight premium, as against metallic currency. Thus, travelers' checks are rather popular, although the bank issuing them charges a commission for their issuance. But all this has no reference whatever to the problem in question. It does not provide a justification for the policies urging the public to resort to the use of banknotes. Governments did not foster the use of banknotes in order to avoid inconvenience to ladies shopping. Their idea was to lower the rate of interest and to open a source of cheap credit to their treasuries. In their eyes, the increase in the quantity of fiduciary media was a means of promoting welfare. Banknotes are not indispensable. All the economic achievements of capitalism would have been accomplished if they had never existed. Besides, deposit currency can do all the things banknotes do, and government interference with the deposits of commercial banks cannot be justified by the hypocritical pretext that poor, ignorant wage earners and farmers must be protected against wicked bankers. But, some people may ask, what about a cartel of the commercial banks? Could not the banks collude for the sake of a boundless expansion of their issuance of fiduciary media? The objection is preposterous. As long as the public is not, by government interference, deprived of the right of withdrawing its deposits, no bank can risk its own goodwill by collusion with banks whose goodwill is not so high as its own. One must not forget that every bank issuing fiduciary media is in a rather precarious position. Its most valuable asset is its reputation. It must go bankrupt as soon as doubts arise concerning its perfect trustworthiness and solvency. It would be suicidal for a bank of good standing to link its name with that of other banks with a poorer goodwill. Under free banking, a cartel of the banks would destroy the country's whole banking system. It would not serve the interests of any bank. For the most part, the banks of good repute are blamed for their conservatism and their reluctance to expand credit. In the eyes of people not deserving of credit, such restraint appears as a vice. But it is the first and supreme rule for the conduct of banking operations under free banking. It is extremely difficult for our contemporaries to conceive of the conditions of free banking because they take government interference with banking for granted and as necessary. However, one must remember that this government interference was based on the erroneous assumption that credit expansion is a proper means of lowering the rate of interest permanently and without harm to anybody but the callous capitalists. The governments interfered precisely because they knew that free banking keeps credit expansion within narrow limits. Economists may be right in asserting that the present state of banking makes government interference with banking problems advisable, but this present state of banking is not the outcome of the operation of the unhampered market economy. It is a product of the various governments' attempts to bring about the conditions required for large-scale credit expansion. If the governments had never interfered, the use of banknotes and of deposit currency would be limited to those strata of the population who know very well how to distinguish between solvent and insolvent banks. No large-scale credit expansion would have been possible. The governments alone are responsible for the spread of the superstitious awe with which the common man looks upon every bit of paper upon which the Treasury or agencies which it controls have printed the magical words, legal tender. Government interference with the present state of banking affairs could be justified if its aim were to liquidate the unsatisfactory conditions by preventing, or at least seriously restricting, any further credit expansion. In fact, the chief objective of present-day government interference is to intensify further credit expansion. This policy is doomed to failure. Sooner or later, it must result in a catastrophe. 13. The size and composition of cash holdings. The total amount of money and money substitutes is kept by individuals and firms in their cash holdings. The share of each is determined by marginal utility. Each is eager to keep a certain portion of his total wealth in cash. He gets rid of an excess of cash by increased purchases and remedies a deficiency of cash by increased sales. The popular terminology confusing the demand for money for cash holding and the demand for wealth and vendable goods must not delude an economist. What is valid with regard to individuals and firms is no less true with regard to every sum of the cash holdings of a number of individuals and firms. The point of view from which we treat a number of such individuals and firms as a totality and sum up their cash holdings is immaterial. The cash holdings of a city, a province, or a country is the sum of the cash holdings of all its residents. Let us assume that the market economy uses only one kind of money, and that money substitutes are either unknown or used in the whole area by everybody without any difference. There are, for example, gold money and redeemable banknotes issued by a world bank and treated by everybody as money substitutes. On these assumptions, measures hindering the exchange of commodities and services do not affect the state of monetary affairs and the size of cash holdings. Tariffs, embargoes, and migration barriers affect the tendencies toward an equalization of prices, wages, and interest rates. They do not react directly upon cash holdings. If a government aims at increasing the amount of cash kept by its subjects, it must order them to deposit a certain amount with an office and to leave it there untouched. The necessity of procuring this amount would force everybody to sell more and to buy less. Domestic prices would drop. Exports would be increased and imports reduced. A quantity of cash would be imported. But if the government were simply to obstruct the importation of goods and the exportation of money, it would fail to attain its goal. If imports drop, other things being equal, exports drop concomitantly. The role money plays in international trade is not different from that which it plays in domestic trade. Money is no less a medium of exchange in foreign trade than it is in domestic trade. Both in domestic trade and in international trade, purchases and sales result in a more than passing change in the cash holdings of individuals and firms, only if people are purposely intent upon increasing or restricting the size of their cash holdings. A surplus of money flows into a country only when its residents are more eager to increase their cash holdings than are the foreigners. An outflow of money occurs only if the residents are more eager to reduce their cash holdings than are the foreigners. A transfer of money from one country into another country, which is not compensated by a transfer in the opposite direction, is never the unintended result of international trade transactions. It is always the outcome of intended changes in the cash holdings of the residents. Just as wheat is exported only if a country's residents want to export a surplus of wheat, so money is exported only if the residents want to export a sum of money, which they consider as a surplus. If a country turns to the employment of money substitutes, which are not employed abroad, such a surplus emerges. The appearance of these money substitutes is tantamount to an increase in the country's supply of money in the broader sense, that is, supply of money plus fiduciary media. It brings about a surplus in the supply of money in the broader sense. The residents are eager to get rid of their share in the surplus by increasing their purchases, either of domestic or of foreign goods. In the first case, exports drop. And in the second case, imports increase. In both cases, the surplus of money goes abroad. As, according to our assumption, money substitutes cannot be exported, only money proper flows out. The result is that within the domestic supply of money in the broader sense, money plus fiduciary media, the portion of money drops and the portion of fiduciary media increases. The domestic stock of money in the narrower sense is now smaller than it was previously. Now we assume further the domestic money substitutes cease to be money substitutes. The bank which issued them no longer redeems them in money. These former money substitutes are now claims against a bank which does not fulfill its obligations, a bank whose ability and willingness to pay its debts is questionable. Nobody knows whether and when they will ever be redeemed. But it may be that these claims are used by the public as credit money. As money substitutes, they had been considered as equivalents of the sum of money to which they gave a claim payable at any moment. As credit money, they are now traded at a discount. At this point, the government may interfere. It decrees that these pieces of credit money are legal tender at their face value. Very often the legal tender quality had been granted to these banknotes at a time when they still were money substitutes, and as such, equal to money in their exchange value. At that time, the decree had no catalactic importance. Now it becomes important because the market no longer considers them money substitutes. Every creditor is bound to accept them in payment at their face value. No trader is free to discriminate against them. The decree tries to force the public to treat things of different exchange value as if they had the same exchange value. It interferes with the structure of prices as determined by the market. It fixes minimum prices for the credit money and maximum prices for the commodity money, gold, and foreign exchange. The result is not what the government aimed at. The difference in exchange value between credit money and gold does not disappear. As it is forbidden to employ the coins according to their market price, people no longer employ them in buying and selling and in paying debts. They keep them or they export them. The commodity money disappears from the domestic market. Bad money, says Gresham's law, drives good money out of the country. It would be more correct to say that the money which the government's decree has undervalued disappears from the market, and the money which the decree has overvalued remains. The outflow of commodity money is thus not the effect of an unfavorable balance of payments, but the effect of a government interference with the price structure. 14. Balances of payments. The confrontation of the money equivalent of all incomings and outgoings of an individual or a group of individuals during any particular period of time is called the balance of payments. The credit side and the debit side are always equal. The balance is always in balance. If we want to know an individual's position in the frame of the market economy, we must look at his balance of payments. It tells us everything about the role he plays in the system of the social division of labor. It shows what he gives to his fellow men and what he receives or takes from them. It shows whether he is a self-supporting, decent citizen or a thief or an almsman. It shows whether he consumes all his proceeds or whether he saves a part of them. There are many human things which are not reflected in the sheets of the ledger. There are virtues and achievements, vices and crimes, that do not leave any traces in the accounts. But as far as a man is integrated into social life and activities, as far as he contributes to the joint effort of society and his contributions are appreciated by his fellow men, and as far as he consumes what is or could be sold and bought on the market, the information conveyed is complete. If we combine the balances of payments of a definite number of individuals and leave out of account the items referring to transactions between the members of this group, we draw up the group's balance of payment. This balance tells us how the members of the group, considered as an integrated complex of people, are connected with the rest of the market society. Thus, we can draw up the balance of payments of the members of the New York Bar, of the Belgian farmers, of the residents of Paris, or of those of the Swiss canton of Bern. Statisticians are mostly interested in establishing the balance of payments of the residents of the various countries, which are organized as independent nations. While an individual's balance of payments conveys exhaustive information about his social position, a group's balance discloses much less. It says nothing about the mutual relations between the members of the group. The greater the group is, and the less homogeneous its members are, the more defective is the information vouchsafed by the balance of payments. The balance of payments of Latvia tells more about the conditions of the Latvians than the United States' balance of payments about the conditions of the Americans. If one wants to describe a country's social and economic condition, one does not need to deal with every single inhabitant's personal balance of payments, but one must not form other groups than such as are composed of members who are, by and large, homogeneous in their social standing and their economic activities. Reading balances of payments is thus very instructive. However, one must know how to interpret them to guard against popular fallacies. It is customary to list separately the monetary and the non-monetary items of a country's balance of payments. One calls the balance favorable if there is a surplus of the imports of money and bullion over the exports of money and bullion. One calls the balance unfavorable if the exports of money and bullion exceed the imports. This terminology stems from inveterate mercantilist errors, unfortunately still surviving in spite of the devastating criticisms of the economists. The imports and exports of money and bullion are viewed as the unintentional outcome of the configuration of the non-monetary items of the balance of payments. This opinion is utterly fallacious. An excess in the exports of money and bullion is not the product of an unhappy concatenation of circumstances that befalls a nation like an act of God. It is the result of the fact that the residents of the country concerned are intent upon reducing the amount of money held and upon buying goods instead. This is why the balance of payments of the gold-producing countries is, as a rule, unfavorable. This is why the balance of payments of a country substituting fiduciary media for a part of its money stock is unfavorable as long as this process goes on. No provident action on the part of a paternal authority is required lest a country lose its whole money stock by an unfavorable balance of payments. Things are, in this regard, not different between the personal balances of payments of individuals and those of groups. Neither are they different between the balances of payments of a city or a district and those of a sovereign nation. No government interference is needed to prevent the residents of New York from spending all their money in dealings with the other 47 states of the Union. As long as any American attaches any weight to the keeping of cash, he will spontaneously take charge of the matter. Thus, he will contribute his share to the maintenance of an adequate supply of money in his country. But if no American were interested in keeping any cash holding, no government measure concerning foreign trade and the settlement of international payments could prevent an outflow of America's total monetary stock. A rigidly enforced embargo upon the exportation of money and bullion would be required. 15. Interlocal exchange rates. Let us first assume that there is only one kind of money. Then, with regard to money's purchasing power at various places, the same is valid as with regard to commodity prices. The final price of cotton in Liverpool cannot exceed the final price in Houston, Texas, by more than the cost of transportation. As soon as the price in Liverpool rises to a higher point, merchants will ship cotton to Liverpool, and thus will bring about a tendency toward a return to the final price. The price of an order for the payment of a definite amount of guilders in Amsterdam cannot rise in New York above the amount determined by the costs involved by remitting the coins, shipment, insurance, and the interest during the period required for all these manipulations. As soon as the difference rises above this point, the gold export point, it becomes profitable to ship gold from New York to Amsterdam. Such shipments force the guilder exchange rate in New York down below the gold export point. A difference between the configuration of interlocal exchange rates for commodities and those for money is brought about by the fact that, as a rule, commodities move only in one direction, namely from the places of surplus production to those of surplus consumption. Cotton is shipped from Houston to Liverpool, and not from Liverpool to Houston. Its price is lower in Houston than in Liverpool by the amount of shipping costs. But money is shipped now this way, now that. The error of those who try to interpret the fluctuations of the interlocal exchange rates and the interlocal shipments of money as determined by the configuration of the non-monetary items of the balance of payments is that they assign to money an exceptional position. They do not see that with regard to interlocal exchange rates, there is no difference between money and commodities. If cotton trade between Houston and Liverpool is possible at all, the cotton prices at these two places cannot differ by more than the total amount of costs required for shipment. In the same way in which there is a flow of cotton from the southern states of the United States to Europe, gold flows from the gold-producing countries like South Africa to Europe. Let us disregard the case of the gold-producing countries, and let us assume that the individuals and firms trading with one another on the basis of the gold standard do not have the intention of changing the size of their cash holdings. From their purchases and sales, claims are generated, which necessitate interlocal payments. But according to our assumption, these interlocal payments are equal in amount. The amount that the residents of A have to pay to the residents of B is equal to the amount that the residents of B have to pay to the residents of A. It is therefore possible to save the costs of shipping gold from A to B and from B to A. Claims and debts can be settled by a sort of interlocal clearing. It is merely a technical problem whether this evening up is affected by an interlocal clearinghouse organization or by the turnovers of a special market for foreign exchange. At any rate, the price which a resident of A or of B has to pay for a payment due in B or in A is kept within the margins determined by the shipment costs. It cannot rise above the par value by more than the shipment costs, gold export point, and cannot fall below the shipment costs, gold import point. It may happen that, all our other assumptions remaining unaltered, there is a temporal discrepancy between the payments due from A to B and those from B to A. Then, an interlocal shipment of gold can only be avoided by the interposition of a credit transaction. If the importer who today has to pay from A to B can buy at the market of foreign exchange only such claims against residents of B as fall due in 90 days, he can save the costs of shipping gold by borrowing the sum concerned in B for a period of 90 days. The dealers in foreign exchange will resort to this makeshift if the costs of borrowing in B do not exceed the costs of borrowing in A by more than double the costs of shipping gold. If the cost of shipping gold is 1/8%, they will be ready to pay for a 3 months loan in B up to 1% pro anno more as interest than corresponds to the state of the money market interest rate at which, in the absence of such requirements for interlocal payments, credit transactions between A and B would be effected. It is permissible to express these facts by contending that the daily state of the balance of payments between A and B determines the point at which, within the margins drawn by the gold export point and the gold import point, the foreign exchange rates are fixed. But one must not forget to add that this happens only if the residents of A and of B do not intend to change the size of their cash holdings. Only because this is the case does it become possible to avoid the transfer of gold altogether and to keep foreign exchange rates within the limits drawn by the two gold points. If the residents of A want to reduce their cash holdings and those of B want to increase theirs, gold must be shipped from A to B, and the rate for cable transfer B reaches in A the gold export point. Then gold is sent from A to B in the same way in which cotton is regularly sent from the United States to Europe. The rate of cable transfer B reaches the gold export point because the residents of A are selling gold to those of B, not because their balance of payments is unfavorable. All this is valid with regard to any payments to be transacted between various places. It makes no difference whether the cities concerned belong to the same sovereign nation or to different sovereign nations. However, government interference has considerably changed the conditions. All governments have created institutions which make it possible for the residents of their countries to make interlocal domestic payments at par. The costs involved in shipment of currency from one place to another are borne either by the Treasury or by the country's central bank system, or by another government bank, such as the postal savings banks of various European countries. Thus, there is no longer any market for domestic interlocal exchange. The public is not charged more for an interlocal order to pay than for a local one, or if the charge is slightly different, it no longer has any reference to the fluctuations of the interlocal movements of currency within the country. It is this government interference which has sharpened the difference between domestic payment and payment abroad. Domestic payments are transacted at par, while with regard to foreign payments, fluctuations occur within the limits drawn by the gold points. If more than one kind of money is used as medium of exchange, the mutual exchange ratio between them is determined by their purchasing power. The final prices of the various commodities, as expressed in each of the two or several kinds of money, are in proportion to each other. The final exchange ratio between the various kinds of money reflects their purchasing power with regard to the commodities. If any discrepancy appears, opportunity for profitable transactions presents itself, and the endeavors of businessmen eager to take advantage of this opportunity tend to make it disappear again. The purchasing power parity theory of foreign exchange is merely the application of the general theorems concerning the determination of prices to the special case of the coexistence of various kinds of money. It does not matter whether the various kinds of money coexist in the same territory or whether their use is limited to distinct areas. In any case, the mutual exchange ratio between them tends to a final state at which it no longer makes any difference whether one buys and sells against this or that kind of money. As far as costs of interlocal transfer come into play, these costs must be added or deducted. The changes in purchasing power do not occur at the same time with regard to all commodities and services. Let us consider again the practically very important instance of an inflation in one country only. The increase in the quantity of domestic credit money or fiat money affects at first only the prices of some commodities and services. The prices of the other commodities remain for some time still at their previous stand. The exchange ratio between the domestic currency and the foreign currencies is determined on the bourse, a market organized and managed according to the pattern and the commercial customs of the stock exchange. The dealers on this special market are quicker than the rest of the people in anticipating future changes. Consequently, the price structure of the market for foreign exchange reflects the new money relation sooner than the prices of many commodities and services. As soon as the domestic inflation begins to affect the prices of some commodities, at any rate, long before it has exhausted all its effects upon the greater part of the prices of commodities and services, the price of foreign exchange tends to rise to the point corresponding to the final state of domestic prices and wage rates. This fact has been entirely misinterpreted. People failed to realize that the rise in foreign exchange rates merely anticipates the movement of domestic commodity prices. They explained the boom in foreign exchange as an outcome of an unfavorable balance of payments. The demand for foreign exchange, they maintained, has been increased by a deterioration of the balance of trade or of other items of the balance of payments, or simply by sinister machinations on the part of unpatriotic speculators. The higher prices to be paid for foreign exchange cause the domestic prices of imported goods to rise. The prices of the domestic products must follow suit, because otherwise their low state would encourage business to withhold them from domestic consumption and to sell them abroad at a premium. The fallacies involved in this popular doctrine can easily be shown. If the nominal income of the domestic public had not been increased by the inflation, they would be forced to restrict their consumption either of imported or of domestic products. In the first case, imports would drop, and in the second case, exports would increase. Thus, the balance of trade would again be brought back to what the mercantilists call a favorable state. Pressed hard, the mercantilists cannot help admitting the correctness of this reasoning. But, they say, it applies only to normal trade conditions. It does not take into account the state of affairs in countries which are under the necessity of importing vital commodities, such as food and essential raw materials. The importation of such goods cannot be curtailed below a certain minimum. They are imported no matter what prices must be paid for them. If the foreign exchange required for importing them cannot be procured by an adequate amount of exports, the balance of trade becomes unfavorable, and the foreign exchange rates must rise more and more. This is no less illusory than all other mercantilist ideas. However urgent and vital an individual's or a group of individuals' demand for some goods may be, they can satisfy it on the market only by paying the market price. If an Austrian wants to buy Canadian wheat, he must pay the market price in Canadian dollars. He must procure these Canadian dollars by exporting goods either directly to Canada or to some other country. He does not increase the amount of Canadian dollars available by paying higher prices, in shillings, the Austrian domestic currency, for Canadian dollars. Moreover, he cannot afford to pay such higher prices in shillings for imported wheat if his income in shillings remains unchanged. Only if the Austrian government embarks upon an inflationary policy and thus increases the number of shillings in the pockets of its citizens are the Austrians in a position to continue to buy the quantities of Canadian wheat they used to buy without curtailing other expenditures. If there were no domestic inflation, any rise in the price of imported goods would result either in a drop in their consumption or in a restriction in the consumption of other goods. Thus, the process of readjustment as described above would have come into motion. If a man lacks the money to buy bread from his neighbor, the village baker, the cause is not to be seen in an alleged scarcity of money. The cause is that this man did not succeed in earning the amount of money needed either by selling goods or by rendering services for which people are prepared to pay. The same is true with regard to international trade. A country may be distressed on account of the fact that it is at a loss to sell abroad as many commodities as it would have to sell in order to buy all the food its citizens want. But this does not mean that foreign exchange is scarce. It means that the residents are poor. And domestic inflation is certainly not an appropriate means to remove this poverty. Neither has speculation any reference to the determination of foreign exchange rates. The speculators merely anticipate the expected alterations. If they err, if their opinion that an inflation is in progress is wrong, the structure of prices and foreign exchange rates will not correspond to their anticipations, and they will have to pay for their mistakes by losses. The doctrine according to which foreign exchange rates are determined by the balance of payments is based upon an illicit generalization of a special case. If two places, A and B, use the same kind of money, and if the residents do not want to make any changes in the size of their cash holdings, over a given period of time, the amount of money paid from the residents of A to those of B equals the amount paid from the residents of B to those of A, and all payments can be settled without shipping money from A to B or from B to A. Then the rate of cable transfer B in A cannot rise above a point slightly below the gold export point, and cannot drop below a point slightly above the gold import point, and vice versa. Within this margin, the daily state of the balance of payments determines the daily state of the foreign exchange rate. This is the case only because neither the residents of A nor those of B want to alter the amount of their cash holdings. If the residents of A want to decrease their cash holdings and those of B to increase theirs, money is shipped from A to B, and the cable rate B reaches in A the gold export point. But money is not shipped because A's balance of payments has become unfavorable. What is called by the mercantilists an unfavorable balance of payments is the effect of a deliberate restriction of cash holdings on the part of the citizens of A, and a deliberate increase in cash holdings on the part of the citizens of B. If no resident of A were ready to reduce his cash holding, such an outflow of money from A could never materialize. The difference between the trade in money and that in the vendable commodities is this. As a rule, commodities move on a one-way road, namely from the places of surplus production to those of surplus consumption. Consequently, the price of a certain commodity in the places of surplus production is, as a rule, lower by the amount of shipping costs than in the places of surplus consumption. Things are different with money if we do not take into account the conditions of the gold mining countries and of those countries whose residents deliberately aim at altering the size of their cash holdings. Money moves now this way, now that. At one time, a country exports money, at another time, it imports money. Every exporting country very soon becomes an importing country, precisely on account of its previous exports. For this reason alone, it is possible to save the costs of shipping money by the interplay of the market for foreign exchange.